From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, just how much bankruptcy help can Detroit really expect to get from Lansing?
I think everybody's just kind of waiting until they really know just what's going to go on before they're all ready to jump in all at the same time.
The 1964 World's Fair opened this day in New York, and Detroit-made cars were the stars.
Cars represented freedom, highways, where we're going to live. We can build bigger. We can expand out to the moon. And no one's thinking at all about the environmental impact of anything.
And we mark this Earth Day by learning some sobering lessons from Finnish moths.
When you look at the numbers, the results are pretty clear. Most moths do worse as the climate changes.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Big news out of Washington today. The United States Supreme Court has upheld Michigan's ban on race and gender-based affirmative action. The court's majority held that Michigan voters were within their rights to amend the state constitution to ban the college admission policies. We'll dive into that decision on today's Stateside. Welcome, I'm Cynthia Canty. Also, this hour, we check in with Michigan Radio's Autobeat reporter, Tracy Samilton, and we'll look at big changes that are likely in the leadership at Ford. And on this Earth Day, what moths can tell us about the world's changing climate. But first, it has taken months of bargaining, bickering, posturing, but there have been promising advances in Detroit's bankruptcy. Pieces are beginning to fall into place that could complete the so-called grand bargain, the one that would protect the DIA collection and soften the blow for Detroit's retirees. First came word of a tentative deal between the city and its pensioners, so now it's on to the next hurdle, getting state lawmakers to approve Michigan's share of the grand bargain, $350 million. We're joined now by Chris Gouts, Capital Correspondent of Crain's Detroit Business. Hello, Chris.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, right after that, I think what everybody would agree was encouraging news about the tentative deal between the cities and the pensioners. Then we hear that House Speaker Jace Bolger says he will not put that $350 million question up for any vote unless the unions put some cash on the table.
Yeah, that's what came out, like you said, in sort of that lineup or that ramp up to that point. And that took a lot of people aback and took some people by surprise, although the Speaker's office said, this is nothing new. We're just reiterating our position. This is something that we've been saying for months now. And I think it's true that did happen. I just don't think it was maybe articulated or people picked up on the fact that he was actually wanting to see skin in the game in terms of financial contributions from the union. But that is now, in fact, what he's saying, that's what he was saying all along when he originally phrased it as contributing materially. Mm. And now he's putting the finite point on saying, we want to see them put money up on the table, as is everyone else in the deal, including, the DIA, which did not have a hand in anything that brought the city to bankruptcy.
So the fact that the general retirees are going to be seeing their monthly pension checks cut, I know that the police and fire will not, but the COLA is affected. But so the individual sacrifices borne by the retirees, that's not what he's talking about.
No, he wants to see money come from the actual union itself and where, in their coffers and seeing them put money up, just as the state is putting up money, the DIA, mm-hmm. other foundations that didn't have a hand in this. He put, not all to blame, but certainly some blame on the unions for putting these, just really untenable, in his terms, contracts in place that the city was never going to be able to pay. Now, of course, it takes two parties to sign a contract, and so the city obviously agreed to those terms, however long ago those came about. And, of course, their skin in the game is the fact that they don't have control of their city anymore. They're under financial managers. So he's saying, since everybody else was putting up money, we're not going to put state money on the table unless the unions themselves put money into this grand bargain.
So since that statement came down at the end of last week, what kind of reaction has there been from all parties? I'm wondering what Kevin Orr might have said and certainly what union reps are saying.
I haven't seen a lot of reaction. I think people are still trying to process it, and mm-hmm. they don't want to. And sometimes they're held back by what they can say in terms of the court orders. But it's been kind of muted, at least aside from the unions, which I think people are just trying to figure out what to say. But they don't want, in the end, they don't want to scuttle this deal, but by going too far out ahead of anything, because at the end of the day, this really does have to get done. And so I think most people believe that it will end up, you know, getting done. But this is another wrinkle now it's part of this. And people, I think to their credit, just didn't jump right out and say, you know, this is ridiculous or this is a terrible idea. I know that the Senate Majority Leader Richardville apparently has said that this isn't a key thing for him. You know, he wants to see as many people participate as possible, but he's not going, at least in his mind, he's not going to require the unions to participate the way that Speaker Bolger is. The governor's office has been kind of mum on the issue, not really saying one way or the other, you know, what the governor thinks, which isn't, you know, that's kind of normal, of course. So, but the unions have been, I think, taken aback by it and obviously oppose it, but we'll see. We're still waiting to see what's actually going to happen here.
We're speaking with Chris Gouts, Capital correspondent of Crain's Detroit Business. And remind us again, when we talk about that $350 million being proposed as the state's share of the grand bargain, where was this to come from? What did Governor Snyder have in mind?
The original idea was, you know, the state receives, it changes every year, but in general terms, the state receives about $250 million a year from the National Tobacco Settlement. And so the idea was is that we would take $17.5 million of that annually for 20 years, which would provide, you know, $350 million of the state's share to that. So this isn't tax dollars, so this is money that's coming from the settlement to be used for these purposes. And so it was thought that that might be sort of the safest way, at least in terms of selling it, because you don't want to, people aren't going to be supportive of a plan that takes their tax dollars,
sure,
you know, from, you know, the UP or even, you know, Oakland County for that matter, and giving it to Detroit to get them out of this mess. And so to some extent it helps that it's not tax dollars, but even if it was $35, okay, it doesn't matter if it's $350 or $350 million or $35 or $350, it's still money to help Detroit, and so you're still going to have a lot of opposition from out-state members who just oppose this just on general principle because they don't want to be seen as bailing out the city, even though, you know, the speaker and the governor are always quick to say this is not a bailout.
We have also heard talk that there could be an arrangement where that money could be paid all up front, and we've heard from the governor's spokesperson, Sarah Werfel, if that happens, it would be a net present value, meaning less than $350 million.
Yeah, that's the idea, is that it would be a smaller amount, but you would just do it all up front. And so right now, as I understand it, the bill drafters are trying to put in place, you know, tentative language that would address either the drawn out, you know, 20-year plan or the lump sum payment, just getting all the ducks in a row in terms of what, the, you know, language they needed for each bill. So it would be less, but in there's still, you know, debate whether should we bond it and use the tobacco money to, you know, to pay off the bonds over 20 years? Should we use the surplus revenue that we have right now and just use that, be over and done with it? So there's debate in that as well. I would think that using tobacco money would still probably be the safest way to go, it sounds like, because otherwise you're going to be using some form of tax dollars.
Would it be better for the city to get it all up front, or is that spreading out maybe more attractive?
No, it sounds like from what I've been able to see, it sounds like they would like it to have the lump sum payment. It would help them in terms of, you know, they would be drawing interest on that, and they would have that money all up front. And I think it would smooth things over much easier.
And, of course, the slippery thing here is that so much is all still tentative and so much depends on Judge Stephen Rhodes, the bankruptcy judge. So when people want to see something hard and fast, it just isn't there.
Yeah, and that's part of the problem in terms of both selling it and just the overall plan, because you'd like to, the House or the legislature isn't going to do anything until they actually get final word from the court that says, you know, We're all done except for you now. So this is the amount we're looking for, and this is, you know, this is what the state would have to do. And at that point, that's when they would be ready to spring into action. And that's why they're doing all this legwork ahead of time. But you know, for Democrats, the point about, you know, bringing the union money into this is really they see a lot of problems with it. One, they think it is a new thing that he's just throwing out there. But two, they also see this sort of a cynical lens. And some reporters, I think, could also be seen as sort of a cynical lens, is that what this would also do is it would deplete the general fund of some of the unions, which would mean that they would have less money right before an election to use to oppose Republican candidates around the state. So that's just one more element to all this, and even putting up, saying that he's not going to do this unless the unions put up the money. He's not guaranteeing that there would be a yes vote if the unions put money into it. He's just guaranteeing that there'd be that they would put up a vote. So I think there's going to be a lot of hesitancy to do anything. I think everybody's just kind of waiting until they really know just what's going to go on before they're all ready to jump in all at the same time.
Mm. What kind of timeline do you see in all of this?
So, well, that's the really tricky thing, is that, you know, every day we go, that there's just less and less time, which obviously is sort of obvious. But in terms of, you know, the legislative calendar, right now the focus is on the state budget. They want to get that done before lawmakers leave for the Mackinac Policy Conference in the last week of May. And then you have the month of June, tentatively right now, scheduled for a full month. But sometimes they feel that they like to leave early, especially in an election year. They want to go home and campaign.
Right.
So you've only got a few weeks' time then. And on top of that, you complicate matters further because you have, you know, some major votes out there still. There's the EAA still out there. Speaker Boulder also wants his transportation plan done, and I think a lot of members would like to get that done before summer break so they can go home to their constituents and say that they brought home money for the roads. And then at this thing, you know, there's still, you know, my guess is that whatever the last day we know possible is to be scheduled in the legislature before summer break, that might be when you see a vote like this take place.
Indeed. Chris Gouts, Capital Correspondent for Crane's Detroit Business. Thank you so much, Chris.
Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. All signs are pointing to a big change on the way at Ford Motor Company. Although the automaker has not made any official announcement, there's much speculation today that CEO Alan Mulally is reportedly ready to retire before the year is out, and COO Mark Fields will ascend the top spot. Michigan Radio's Autobeat reporter Tracy Samilton joins us now. Now, a lot of speculation?
Yes, and you got to keep in mind some of these reports were single-sourced, so that's important. Bloomberg was the only entity I'm aware of that managed to get two people agreeing that this was going to happen. So we don't know for sure, but it is going to be true eventually.
And we had heard, of course, that Alan Mulally was in the running to be Microsoft's new CEO. Now, that didn't happen, but did it open the door to stepping up a retirement at Ford, do you think?
You know, there were some rumors, and that's as far as it really got, that Bill Ford wasn't happy about it, and the members of the board were not happy about
feeling
it.
Feeling it maybe distracted from the vehicle launch.
Yeah, right, right. And a lot of analysts also were grumbling about it, but it's really hard to say.
But realizing that Mark Fields has certainly been the heir apparent since he was promoted in December 2012 to the chief operating officer, let's say this all does play out. What strengths do you think he brings to the CEO job?
Well, Mark was actually pretty – he started the restructuring at Ford. He had a plan called The Way Forward, which Alan Mulally inherited and changed a bit. But it really was the template for this massive restructuring at Ford Motor Company. He knew what was going wrong. Mm-hmm. He's been with Ford for a long time, 25 years. He knows the company from top to bottom. And I think he's really learned from Alan Mulally. In fact, he says, I'm going to keep those Thursday meetings where all the top executives come and say what's going right and what's going wrong. And we help each other out
without
as a team.
Without fear.
Without fear, exactly. And he's also even started a second meeting like that, solely focused on quality. So I think we're going to see him sort of keep what Alan has done and continue to expand on it.
Well, it's kind of interesting. We could be seeing the departure of a second auto outsider to head a car company, with GM's Dan Akerson being the first, succeeded by a lifer in Mary Barra, and now Mulally to be succeeded by a lifer like Mark Fields. So auto folks back at the helm again.
Yeah. And there's both good and bad to both those situations. You have an outsider coming into GM, for example, mm-hmm. and something of an outsider, even though Alan came from Boeing, which is a similar type industry. They can see right away where the company's not working the way it should because they're not invested in what has been going on. But at the same time, you've got Dan Akerson. When he was in charge of GM, he admitted, I'm not a car guy. And so now you're going to have Mark Fields in charge of Ford, and you're going to have Mary Barra in front of General Motors. Mm-hmm. Both of them are car gals, car mm-hmm. guys, and know that business from top to bottom. And that is also a strength that they have.
Michigan Radio's auto reporter Tracy Samilton. As always, thank you, Tracy.
I'm happy to be here.
It's no exaggeration to say that cars ruled that World's Fair. Detroit's Big Three worked very hard to grab the world's attention. We wanted to talk about what those messages were and how the Detroit Three weren't just selling cars. They were pushing a lifestyle and a political system.
People hardly know where to begin when they step into the world of the fair. It has something of everything, something for everyone.
Well, let's talk about the world of the fair as we're joined now by Joseph Tirella. His book is Tomorrowland, the 1964-65 World's Fair and the Transformation of America. Joseph, so good to have you with us.
It's great to be here.
As those gates swung open 50 years ago this day, we're wondering how much of the fair was dedicated to the Detroit Three and their exhibits?
Well, all three of them were there and had huge pavilions. In the 64 World's Fair is often talked about as all the corporate American pavilions that were there. But the Big Three were the three of the most popular. Cars were always central to the World's Fair, and all three exhibited at the previous New York World's Fair in 1939. And General Motors might have been carrying the biggest burden in that in 1939, they constructed the exhibit known as Futurama. And inside of that was the city of tomorrow and a vision of the world of tomorrow. So in 1964, they had this kind of legacy to live up to. Their plan right away was to do Futurama 2, which is to update this vision of the city of tomorrow. Again, because in 1939, the city of tomorrow that they showed was supposed to be America in 1960. Mm-hmm. So here we were in 1964, they had to kind of up the ante. So everyone was looking forward to that because the people who went to the first World's Fair, you know, remembered it as a kid, and they saw this vision in 1939 of skyscrapers and superhighways and cars. Now, I know it may not be a stretch of the imagination to think that General Motors would think the future of America included cars, but the future of America did include cars, so they were accurate in that way.
Well, we certainly saw as America got out of World War II and the Greatest Generation came home, and what did they do? They built the superhighways,
right.
And we saw
that's
that
right.
All through the 50s. And it is interesting, you think about it, how much we take cars for granted now, but give us a sense, if you can, Joe, how our parents and grandparents were thinking of cars and regarding cars in 1964 when the fair opened.
Well, by that time, everyone had a car, and a car really symbolized American freedom. I mean, you have to remember, this is 20 years. In 1964, it's 20 years after the end of the Second World War.
Mm-hmm.
In 1939, they must have looked at that vision of that General Motors laid out and said, wow, because, I mean, this is the Great Depression's been going on for 10 years. You know, hadn't fully recovered in 1939, and then the war happens. The war ends, everyone comes home, and they start building suburbia, they start expanding, you know, outside of cities, and you need highways to get there. So they build the highway, international highway system. And then, some, you know, everyone needs cars, and Detroit is booming with cars, and the American car industry is, it's the envy of the world over. So now in 1964, the idea that it's kind of a given that you would need a car. Now, maybe people don't have two, three cars like they do today or whatever, but every family is going to have a car. So when you go to the 64 Fair, and at the Ford Pavilion, they debut the Ford Mustang. You know, nowadays we think of the Ford Mustang as kind of, you know, it's a cool car, maybe it's even borderline a muscle car,
right.
Something that, like, maybe guys would want to drive. But in 1964, and you see the picture of the fair, it was sold as a family car. Even the convertible. I mean, the Ford Pavilion, I mean, they were brilliant piece of strategy. And maybe they thought, you know, we can't really compete with this Futurama stuff with General Motors. But what we're going to do is we're going to hire Walt Disney. We're going to get him to build us a ride. And then, since it's going to be long lines, and there were, we're going to put people in actual Ford Mustangs. And we're going to move them throughout the pavilion until you get to the ride on a conveyor belt. So everyone kind of has a test drive. And the whole family can sit in the car and be entertained by this Walt Disney ride.
And then using the genius of Walt Disney and his Imagineers, take a quick listen here.
Step into the wide world of Ford. This pavilion is a bridge between the past and the future.
So before we ever had Disney World in Orlando, so of course we had Disneyland out in California, but it really
right.
did give a much bigger chunk of Americans a chance to experience kind of that Disney magic and tie it in with the Mustang and with Ford.
That's why he got involved. Disney himself, Moses actually personally called on him to
and
get
Moses
involved.
Being Robert Moses.
Robert Moses, the New York City master builder. He wanted Disney involved, and Moses was not one to share the spotlight, but he was all too happy to promote Walt Disney as one of the stars of his show.
Yeah.
But even before Moses contacted him, Disney had a meeting with all his top people, and he said, listen, they're building a World's Fair out in New York City, and all these corporations are going to throw millions of dollars, and then they're not going to know what the hell to do, so we're going to do it for them. And so all along he had this agenda that he wanted to get involved because he loved World's Fairs, and obviously he knew how to entertain people,
yeah.
And he had no East Coast theme park yet. So he thought this would be a way to show people on the other side of the Mississippi who hadn't made it out to California in his park,
sure.
What Disney's form of entertainment's like, and actually uses a testing ground. He also used all the money from corporations like Ford and Pepsi, who also he built a pavilion for, to to get his audio animatronics and all that technology that his Imagineers, as he called them, built.
And Chrysler's exhibit was a mini theme park?
Yeah, it was kind of a mini theme park that looked like a massive candy-colored car engine. Maybe that's the kindest way of putting it.
Okay.
It was, at the time that the fair opened in 64, pop art was around. So when Chrysler opened, someone there had to have it in their mind. Like, they thought of it as this kind of like, you see those when Madison Avenue kind of got their hand on, like, the psychedelic 60s and
yes.
Everything was, like, Dago colors.
Yes.
That's kind of what was happening. It's someone's idea of, like, hey, let's be cool, young, and hip, since we can't really compete with General Motors, and we don't have a Ford Mustang or something like it. Let's have something just kind of outside of the box. And we're going to have this big kind of mini theme park, this 80-foot massive engine. Of the big three pavilions, it's the one that looks like 1964.
I'm speaking with Joseph Tarella. His book is Tomorrowland, the 1964-65 World's Fair and the Transformation of America. And I want to circle back now to something we touched on at the beginning of our conversation, Joe, and that was General Motors looking into the future in the 1939 World's Fair, and then in 1964 decided to do it again with Futurama 2.
Right.
Welcome to Futurama 2. Welcome to a journey into the future. A journey for everyone today into the everywhere of tomorrow. Let us explore together the future. A future not of dreams, but of reality. It is now tomorrow.
What was GM's reality then? What was there tomorrow? It's here, it's now. What was that?
Part of it was this idea that in the future, I mean, they got this part right. They said that, there would be missions to the moon, which obviously was already on the agenda, mm-hmm. and NASA was working on it. They said there'd be a space station, which, it kind of looks like the space station we have now. But they have this idea, and this is really kind of Jetsons-like sci-fi fiction, that we would be living, or at least visiting, underwater and staying in hotels, and that we can build housing underwater. And people would go down there and see, live under the ocean, which, when you think about it, is probably, besides a far-fetched idea, it's probably a really bad idea. Considering how polluted the oceans are now, we can only imagine how polluted they would be if, like, say, 1 million to 2 million people were living under the water.
Right.
And I think this is the part is what happens in 1939, everyone's looking towards tomorrow because
it was horrible. It was the Depression.
Exactly. And the kind of economic prosperity that they were promising was around the corner, but it was going to be a long corner, right, after the war.
Yes.
In 64, that prosperity, people had been living with it for 20 years, more or less.
Mm-hmm.
So what could the future be? And already, the government said, President Kennedy said we should bring a man to the moon and bring him back safely to Earth. And NASA was in the middle of doing that. You're also at this weird moment where it's the space race. So although it's 1964 and no one's been to the moon yet, the idea that it's going to happen is there in everyone's mind.
Yeah.
It's almost like the future is imminent. So how does someone like GM, you want to look past that? You want to look down the line. What is the future? Since we're putting on, we're planning on putting a man on the moon in the next couple of years, what's going to happen 30 years from now, 40 years from now, 50 years from now? And I think that's maybe where they got into a little bit of trouble, because then you're just basically competing with Hollywood science fiction movies.
Yeah.
And we're not living underwater, and that's probably a good thing.
I think absent from all of these shiny visions was virtually any thought about the environmental or the social impact of cars.
Oh, yeah. Correct. That was not there at all. And I think that's another thing that represents the mindset of the fair in 64. People have been asking me, well, how come we don't do these things anymore? How come we don't have World's Fairs? And yeah. They do exist in other countries. But, you know, in 1964, you hit it on the head. People talking about cars. Cars represented freedom, highways, where we're going to live. We can build bigger. We can expand out to the moon. And no one's thinking at all about the environmental impact of anything. You know, let's live underwater. Let's build hotels. You know, we have a housing crisis. We'll put people underwater. I mean, that's getting into all sorts of potentially dangerous problems. How much electricity do you have to burn to make enough light so that you can, you know, light up the bottom of the ocean so people can see?
Nobody cared. And drive. Gas was, $0.05, $0.10 a gallon.
No one cared in the least. That's the real difference
yeah.
between 1964 America and now. There was no talk about the environmental impact of anything.
And knowing that at that point in 1964, there we were in the Cold War, we had a very wary eye on the Iron Curtain and what was on the other side, communism. So give us a sense of what that 1964 World's Fair and the Detroit 3 were trying to sell. It wasn't only cars.
No, I mean, all World's Fairs are trying to sell something.
Yeah.
The 64 World's Fair was trying to sell America as the beacon of, you know, democracy's light throughout the world. And that was also part of the problem, because even in during the Kennedy years, when President Kennedy was assassinated 5 months to the day before the fair opened, you know, one of the reasons why he came out with his civil rights bill on June 11th was to say, you know, he actually uses words like this. He said, you know, we promote democracy around the world, and we mean it. But how are we going to do that if we sit here and say, you know, we have no second-class citizens, we have no master race in America, except, of course, for blacks? That's what he said. The fair, of course, was still promoting America and American corporations as just a force for good in the world. And yet, here we were, and there were protests and civil rights, you know, actions the first day of the World's Fair. President Johnson came to the World's Fair to give a speech, and he was shouted down by 200 college activists who were saying, you know, we have a World's Fair, but we don't have a fair world, and that sort of thing. You know, the shininess and the hope of the World's Fair, peace through understanding, was a wonderful idea, but it didn't really jive with what was happening in the country.
And as you write in your book, that fair in 1964-65 marked the beginning of the end of an era in American history. So we were saying goodbye to things without even knowing it at the time, weren't we?
That's right. People did not know that this was the end. They thought it was a new beginning. And instead, it was the end of that post-war period, the end of kind of the black and white Eisenhower years, or even the black and white of the so-called Camelot Kennedy years, and we were going full force into the Technicolor in the 1960s, and I don't think people really knew that. I mean, writing the book and researching the early parts of the 1960s, the whole political history, there was a lot going on. And the fair itself, which is why I wrote the book, is kind of overshadowed between the early part of the 60s and then what happens later. Because what happens later is, you know, peace and drugs and sex and rock and roll and Woodstock and
Vietnam,
lots of assassinations and Vietnam and race riots, you know, stuff that you could really see. The thing about the 60s is you can see it. You know, you can actually see Bobby Kennedy dying on film. You can see what Vietnam must have been like, at least a little bit, for some of the troops, because you can see the footage. You can see Woodstock. You can see all these people in the shows. You can see the race riots. Whereas it's kind of harder to, like, well, how do you show the fear people felt in the Cold War? You know, that's a little harder. A lot of what happened after the fair, it's all captured on television. And that's probably why it was maybe more the focus of the decade as opposed to some of the other parts.
Joseph Terrella, his book is Tomorrowland, the 1964-65 World's Fair and the Transformation of America. Very fun to talk to you, Joseph. Thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
Great. It's great to be here. Thank you very much.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The U.S. Supreme Court today upheld Michigan's ban on race and gender-based affirmative action in college admissions. A 6-2 majority on the court held that Michigan voters were indeed within their rights to amend the state constitution to ban the admission policies. Rick Pluta is Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Hi, Rick.
Hi, Cindy.
So exactly what did the court say today?
Well, what the court said is that there's nothing in the Constitution, nothing in the law, either statutory or in case law, that says that the judiciary can set aside a decision like this that was made by voters. They said that this was not about affirmative action itself, that affirmative action is still constitutional, but that voters can set some limits on it.
So this decision overturns a ruling from the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. Tell us exactly what that was.
Sure. That decision by the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals sitting in Cincinnati said that really the affirmative action amendment, it was approved by state voters in 2006. Well, it's outside of what voters can decide. And it said that's because it sets aside a group basically of racial minorities who now have to work harder to change an admissions policy, unlike, well, low-income people, wealthy donors, legacy admissions, or athletes. None of them have to go change the state constitution, get voters to go along with that, to get a more favorable admissions policy. They can just go and talk to university officials. Now, that group of people, racial minorities, they have to go and convince voters to change the state constitution to get what they want. It's set a higher bar.
Okay. So breakdown, we had this 6-2 ruling. Why did the Supreme Court say that decision shouldn't stand?
Well, what the Supreme Court said, and we should note that this was a divided ruling, that there was not a majority opinion. There was a majority, but there was a plurality opinion joined by a couple of concurrences, a couple of dissents, and Justice Elena Kagan sat out the case. We don't know if that's because of her history as a Solicitor General with the Clinton administration or because she was once a dean at Harvard. But what the plurality of the court said is that Sixth Circuit decision we were just talking about, that made life too complicated. How do you decide which minority groups deserve protection? Whether there's a sense of unanimity within that group, and then what kinds of protections that group might want. They said it's cleaner and easier for voters to decide. And then if voters decide it's not working, they can go back and change it themselves. And what the majority agreed on, that this affirmative action controversy is exactly the sort of question that's supposed to be decided in the push and pull of politics, of ballot campaigns. So that court plurality, Justices Kennedy, Roberts, and Alito, they said that even though this was not a decision about affirmative action, they did say where voters have reined in affirmative action, there's nothing stopping universities from going out and finding new and creative ways to encourage diversity on their campuses.
Well, how about the dissenters, Rick? Because they said, hey, that's not happening.
That's true. The dissent, Justices Sotomayor and Ginsburg said that race still matters. It's naive to think otherwise, and that this essentially means that minority admissions will fall where these sorts of limits are enacted. That's what happened in California and in Michigan. By the way, opponents of affirmative action, they say that admissions, it's kind of a faulty measure, that it's better to look at graduation rates and what happens when more minority applicants wind up going to, well, less prestigious schools.
Now, Rick, you were there. I remember we talked to you last October when you were there at the Supreme Court. You heard the arguments on both sides. What kind of reactions are coming down today to the court's decision?
Well, just a few minutes ago, we got out of a news conference with Attorney General Bill Schuette. He was defending the amendment. So, as you can imagine, he says the Supreme Court got it right. And he said that the court got it right when it said voters get to decide this question. And he said that Michigan voters got it right in 2006 when they said race, gender, ethnicity don't have a place in admissions decisions. Now, we did press him on that point. What would be appropriate then? Would it be an economic test, for example, or maybe coming from a region that has historically low admission rates? Would that be appropriate? But he wouldn't bite. The losers in this case say this is bad news for minorities who would like to go to college, that the numbers already show that without affirmative action, it's simply harder for minorities to be admitted, especially to higher end institutions like the University of Michigan. However, they were pleased that the court did not out-and-out strike down affirmative action. They said it's still constitutional, but voters are allowed to set parameters around it. And we may actually see that soon in Missouri, Utah, and down in Ohio.
Rick Pluta, Lansing Bureau Chief for the Michigan Public Radio Network. Thank you so much, Rick.
My pleasure, Cindy.
Many consider April 22, 1970 to be the birth of the modern environmental movement. Now, at that time, Earth Day organizers had an advantage. The environmental problems were highly visible, tangible problems people bumped up against in their daily lives. Toxic effluent from factories spilling into streams and rivers. A stretch of the Cuyahoga River in Cleveland actually burst into flames. Kids couldn't swim in lakes and rivers because they were too polluted. Parks and highways were strewn with trash, and air pollution made people sick. You could draw a direct connection between these problems and the need for environmental action to improve everyone's quality of life. Many of today's biggest environmental concerns seem more abstract, even though they are perhaps even more threatening than the burning river in Cleveland. Global warming is one example, and that's why a study by our next guest caught our eye. He found that what's happening to moths in Finnish Lapland suggests that we're underestimating the impacts of climate change because much of the harm is hidden from view. Mark Hunter is a professor of ecology and evolutionary biology at the University of Michigan. Welcome.
It's great to be here.
So this was a 32-year study of subarctic forest moths in Finnish Lapland. What was the quest? What were you searching for?
So I've got a very dedicated team of Finnish ecologists who started this work, you know, over three decades ago. And at that time, people weren't really considering climate change or were just starting to think about it a little bit. And so really, they were interested in studying the ecology of these subarctic forests. But through, you know, many, many dedicated years of counting moths and identifying moths, they end up with a very, very rare thing, which is a continuous data set for a large number of species collected in the same way at exactly the same place.
So it's a really, when you look at that from 1978 to 2009, that's some very, very important data.
It is, because it spans a period during which there were some major climatic shifts in that part of the world. And so as the climate has been changing in Finnish Lapland, we can then watch what happens to those moth populations.
And what is it about the moth that makes it such a good subject for study?
Well, in many ways, moths are easy in some respects. They're much easier to count, for example, than herds of caribou.
True.
But at the same time, you know, they're great integrators of environmental variation. So they respond to changes in temperature, to changes in precipitation, but also to changes in the quality of what they eat and how many enemies they have. And so they integrate all of those ecological processes. And if we just count them over long periods of time, look at how those populations are changing, we can start to understand how the ecology is working.
So, Mark, give us a sense then, from 1978 to 2009, what did you find first in terms of the climate?
So, honestly, the first time I saw the plots, I was completely astonished. It's the most rapid evidence of climate change that I've ever seen. The temperatures, the average temperatures in Finnish Lapland, where my colleagues were working, increased by 3.5 Fahrenheit over a period of just 30 years. That's an astonishingly rapid increase in temperature. We also saw some big increases in winter precipitation as well.
So it got warmer and it got wetter.
Yep.
What effect did that have on the moth populations?
Well, the first surprise was that when we looked at moth populations over the same period, most moth populations actually seemed to be relatively stable or even going up. And so that was the first surprise. There was major climate change taking place, but apparently stable or increasing moth populations.
Which a civilian might look at and go, hey, that isn't that good news?
Well, that's what we thought. We got quite excited by that idea that maybe after all this was some good news for climate change. But we had to take a step backwards and think about the difference between simply associating a change in moth populations with climate and more causal relationships.
So if you look at the data in different ways and dig more deeply as you did, what did you really find then about the population?
So we used a statistical technique which allowed us to say, well, if we keep everything else constant, what happens to the rate of population growth in particularly warm years or particularly cold years or particularly wet years or particularly dry years? Mm-hmm. And when we did that, it became pretty clear that climate change was actually bad for moths. In years where it was particularly warm, moths grew more slowly. And in years where it was particularly wet, population growth rates went down. So overall, we had this hidden effect of climate change whereby increasing temperatures, increasing precipitation were bad for moths.
So you kind of found that basically something, some factor that wasn't measured kind of masked the negative effects of climate change. What does that mean and what might that be?
So there are many possibilities. And so one of the problems, I suppose, is that our focus on moths means that we don't really know what it is that's buffering their populations from climate change at the moment. In some ways, it's good news, right? There's something out there which is helping our moth populations be stable or even increase. And we have some guesses. We've seen some changes in forest structure. So there's more trees, larger bushes, less herbs, more leaf litter. And those are all things that moths might like. At the same time, we don't have any direct way to find the real answer as to why the moth populations are staying better than we expected them to.
Do you think someone who does not believe global warming is such a major threat might look at this and say, see, nature is protecting her own and there's not such a grave threat from global warming after all?
Yeah, anytime something like this happens, it provides ammunition to both sides, doesn't it? Mm. What you have to do, I suppose, at the end of the day is look at what the data really tell you. Look hard at the numbers and use whatever scientific tools you can to try and understand those numbers. Put bias aside and see what the numbers say. And unfortunately, in this particular case, when you look at the numbers, the results are pretty clear. Most moths do worse as the climate changes.
So what I'm hearing is that we may have been underestimating the effects of global warming and climate change because it's being masked, in a sense, and buffered.
That's the bigger message beyond Finnish moths. Mm-hmm. You know, we know it's happening in Finnish moths because we have this unusually powerful data set, this excellent 32-year time span, right? We don't have that for many organisms. Mm-hmm. What that means is that we don't know how often the negative effects of climate change are being masked by other things. We know it happens for Finnish moths, but we don't know how common that is. And if it's as common in other systems as it is in Finland, then there's a real problem.
I'm wondering, as an ecologist, and here we are speaking on the 44th anniversary of Earth Day, what do you feel have been the biggest successes of the Earth Day movement?
To me, any time you get an engaged and informed public involved in issues of the environment as a success. So every time we celebrate Earth Day, that in itself is a success. But the greatest change that happens, whether you're talking about urban, suburban, or wildland communities, is when people get involved and people are interested in protecting what matters to them. And so the big success of the environmental movement comes when we engage local people in protecting their local environments.
When you think that first Earth Day, there were some 20 million people involved, and has it faded into the woodwork, do you fear?
There's no question there's a less of a motivation today than there was then. As you point out, some of the problems are harder to see. That doesn't make them any less important. I also think that we might get diverted by the activities that people enjoy on a daily basis. Sometimes we need to put down our cell phones and stop texting and maybe just think for a few minutes about going outside, looking at the environment and seeing how it's doing.
What are the gravest challenges do you think that we face on this 44th Earth Day?
Without question, it's a global climate change. There's no doubt in my mind that if we continue to burn fossil fuels at the current rate and don't do anything to mitigate or reduce the impact of all of that carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, we're going to see profound changes, not just to plants and animals, but to human health as well. Not everybody is motivated by changes in moth populations, and I understand that. But when, for example, we hear that as mosquitoes move up in elevation in Colombia and Ethiopia, and that will cause 3 million more children to suffer from malaria. Those are very tangible effects on human health. And I think those are the kinds of motivating factors that ought to make us think a bit harder about what we're doing.
Mark Hunter, Professor of Ecology and Evolutionary Biology at the University of Michigan. Thank you so much for joining us on this Earth Day.
Well, thanks for having me.
Now everybody from the 313, put your up in the hands up and follow me. Everybody from the 313, put your up in the hands up. Look, look.
Well, of course, that is Detroit-based rapper Eminem in the movie 8 Mile giving a shout-out to his city's area code. But it appears the 313 is on its way out. Even with Detroit's dwindling population, cell phone use is on the rise, and the city is running out of the 7 numbers to follow that 313 area code. So according to reports, the last of the 313 phone numbers should be given out in the year 2018, which means we still have 4 more years until that 313 number becomes extra exclusive. Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Allie Billings, Emily Fox, Renee Gross, Chris Hattlesey, Mercedes Mejia, Katie Suha, Omar Sude, Claire Tennisketter, and Jeff Warniak. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. Support for the Detroit Journalism Cooperative comes from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation and the Ford Foundation. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening, and let's talk tomorrow afternoon at 3 o'clock.